Man is a microcosm, or little world, because he is an extract from all the stars and planets of the whole firmament, from the earth and of the elements, and so he is their quintessence. You're listening to a Western World's special presentation. For another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, home to students from 117 countries and located in London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's quote comes from the 16th century Renaissance scientist Paracelsus. While he could not have possibly have known the literal truth to his words written 400 years before the theory of nucleosynthesis, he captured an essential aspect of humanity's relationship with the cosmos. Without sentient life, there is no one to ponder the depths of the heavens, to thrill at exploring the planets, or to marvel at the complexity of nature as revealed by science. In short, I would like to believe that humanity, in a very small way, gives meaning and significance to our universe. In the same way, there would be no Western Worlds without the hard-working team that produces this show every week. Over the past season and a bit, you've learned about us through our interviews and through our roundtables. But it makes sense to properly meet all of the stars in the Western Worlds firmament. Tonight, we present a conversation with the co-hosts, and transitioning us to that discussion is Mike Oldfield's Imperium. Western Worlds have realized that we've gone a whole cycle now, a whole season, without even introducing who it is that we are. Now, we do have a little bit of information on our website under the host bios, but I thought it would be nice to give you a chance to meet the whole Western Worlds team. So why don't we start off with Alyssa, our co-host, our producer here at the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration. Really someone who's been with us since the beginning, one of the reasons this thing takes place every week. So tell us a little bit about what is it that you do here at CPSX.
Well, my role is a little different than everyone else who is here. I'm the outreach coordinator for the CPSX. So that means I get to go out into the classrooms and do stuff with kids from grade kindergarten all the way up to grade 12, stuff with the public. I also develop activities, work with graduate students, do that kind of thing. So like you said, that my role with this program is producer of the show, and that's mostly only because Dr. John, you wanted a contact to be like, yeah, we should do this. And so now here I am.
Well, this is a great thing. I mean, we've got a lot of institutional support here for this kind of an initiative, don't we?
We do. I mean, we talked with Dr. Gordon Ozinski, who's a big leader in the CPSX, and he's very supportive of this initiative, especially after he found out that the first episode, we got about 20,000 people listening. I mean, it's a great opportunity for the CPSX to get our name out there. So we've had support. They've helped buy the recorder, for example, the equipment that we use, and print off flyers that we've given out at conferences. So, yeah, it's been a really great supportive environment to work in.
Yeah, and it seems to have been really well received by the staff and students. And
it has, yeah. I mean, people are interested in it and actually listen to it, and people want to be interviewed for the show. And I mean, we have visitors that come to the university and are excited to be interviewed for the show, and I mean, we've had people come up and say, oh, hey, I know you from the radio. And so it's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really neat. And I mean, one of the great things that really makes this show really, really click is the fact that we have so many different people here at CPSX with a different take on science and exploration. And so
we actually get to come together and sort of argue what is it that these interviews mean. And I've been very impressed with the people who have just come and shown up to help, like people like Dave Kirsch over there. So what's your connection with CPSX?
It's Alyssa who brought me in. I was not doing anything for a little while after leaving academia. My research for a while was in planetary studies. So I was studying the formation of planetary systems. And it was all really cool, really exciting stuff, really interesting. But eventually I realized that I really enjoyed the teaching aspects of academia, and I really enjoyed the outreach aspects. But perhaps the research aspect was not so much something that I necessarily wanted to be doing. So now, these days, I'll be doing teaching, and it was Alyssa who brought me in when I contacted her about outreach opportunities.
Yeah, what's interesting, Dave and I actually met at a planetary science short course
like 7 years
Whistler
ago.
And we've kind of been in contact ever since because we've both been involved in doing outreach while you were at Mac, and then when I was here at Western doing my PhD, so we kind of just kept in contact.
Yeah, at McMaster, I was working at the planetarium an awful lot, which was a great way to get involved with the public and to talk about some really interesting stuff all the time. It was really fun. So I'm very glad to find out that Western here has an opportunity to continue doing so, and especially something that's so well run.
So what kind of teaching are you doing or working towards?
College and university starting in the fall. So it's going to be keeping me busy.
I noticed that you mentioned that you sort of grew up reading a lot of science fiction.
Yeah,
Well, is it something that sort of, you know, led you into this type of a career?
For sure. I think occasionally I've met scientists who aren't necessarily fans of science fiction. I've always personally found that kind of surprising because that was my path. Yeah, it was to be really interested in the science and in the really imaginative aspects of science. And still mainly read science fiction, still mainly a nerd in that way. But it sure helped me get into the mind frame of academia and actually do science, which requires a good deal of imagination.
That's a good way of putting it. I mean, and I think there's some truth to that for all of us here. I won't say put up your hands because you won't hear that on the radio.
I'm glad.
And is that just sort of generally true around here?
Definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. I grew up watching The Adventures of Captain Kirk and
college. You're that old?
reruns.
He was born in the 1940s.
imagining, the exploring new worlds and seeing new things. I grew up in a city that had, it only existed because there was an impact crater in Sudbury, the products of which we can mine today. And it's kind of isolated in the middle of the forest, 100 kilometers from anything else. And so this idea of being on the frontier and being connected to the broader universe sort of shaped my perceptions of how to fit into the world.
Well, clearly I'm in the minority because I was not into science fiction when I was younger at all. It wasn't until probably university Contact, actually, 1997, when Contact, that movie
Such
came out.
Movie. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the very influential movies, shall we say. And then I read the book, and then I read all Carl Sagan's books, and he's one of my great influences on being in education and outreach. I didn't blossom into my science nerdiness until much later, I guess.
It is interesting to see how that kind of comes across, though, when you talk to real-life people. I mean, in our first season, for instance, I mean, we had Catherine Nishan, who probably reminds me of Ellie Arroway more than anyone else out there. And coming up, we'll talk with someone from SETI this particular upcoming season. Now, the interviewer for that, Barshadi, is here with us today. So what was it that really got you into doing science and this science outreach that we're doing here?
I think from where I grew up, astronomy is not that big of a thing. So you're either a doctor or an engineer there. So I think my like for astronomy started when I visited planetarium in one of the biggest cities in India. And that was the first time I just picked up a book that took me years to understand. I didn't understand until I got into university. So that was the main deal. I just purchased a random book about astronomy, and then I didn't understand half of it. And I was like, maybe
it's got beautiful pictures.
Yeah, it got beautiful pictures, but then I don't understand what they're talking about. So maybe that's where actually it started, that, maybe this is an interesting thing. Maybe I can study. And then it turns out my mom was interested in planets. The other way, I'm not going to talk about that. But she got me enrolled in astronomy clubs in my city, and that's where actually I picked up this liking for astronomy so much that I came to Canada just to study astronomy.
Yeah, that's some neat stuff. And I noticed that you study migration of giant planets. That's really on the cutting edge, something we wouldn't have suspected even 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, actually that was my undergrad research project. So when I was looking for someone to work with, I actually really wanted to work in planetary, even though at my university I was doing physics and astronomy. But my love for planetary was always there. I think it's in my genes, I think. So when I contacted Dr. Artimovs and he said he has a project on migration of planets, and it's a type 3 migration, which he's still working on. It's not actually, like, if you look at it in the textbook, it's just type 1 and type 2 migration. So this is a type 3, which he's trying to get the whole theory about, which is migration of giant planets outward. Now that we see many exoplanets which are very far away from their host star, so the whole theory about how they actually got there is actually type 3 migration. And I thought it was really interesting modeling those kind of things. It did scare me at first, because I'm not that of a computer geek. But yeah, it worked out. He's still working on it, and hopefully someday it'll be good theory.
Well, I've noticed that with a lot of scientists, is that the tools, so things like computer codes and whatnot, you know, we're not there salivating and ripping apart our box late at night so much as it's something that we use to do our work to understand what's out there.
Well, if we liked computers, we would have become computer scientists, not astronomers.
Yeah.
Not planetary scientists.
That's true. And, of course, you're listening now to our own Tyler August, the other man from Sudbury.
Yeah, I grew up in the same crater as Raymond, slightly... On the other side of the
crater. Which part of the crater?
I was down in the base in the valley.
Okay. I was just outside the rim for me.
Yeah, so every day, my public school was actually on the crater rim. So every day, the bus would climb the crater rim to take me to school. I went to high school on the other side of town, so I would climb out of the crater through high school, out of the crater, off into the highlands of the city.
The ejecta blanket has long since been eroded away.
Well, yeah.
But it is. It's about 2.5 billion years old now, isn't it?
1.85. Yeah.
That's true. We can date that one.
It's a relatively young one.
And Lake Wanapitei.
I think it's about 30 million or so.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. Something like that. It's mostly underwater, though, so...
Well, yes. No, the planetary scientists don't care about it so much because it is too underwater to study, but it's great fishing. So I lived in one crater, and I'd go fishing in the other crater. Mm-hmm. Lightning does strike twice, folks. If you wait a few billion years.
Yeah.
And of course, Raymond also mentioned, with that crater up in Labrador, that you have the same sort of thing. You have a waterway that goes in, it's good for fish. These things do have applications in daily life.
And the fish are good in Lake Mistassin. They're, man, we had an Innu guide who caught some for us. They're excellent.
So actually, it was partly the fact that I was in the crater that got me interested. Mm-hmm. You know, that's natural. Okay, I'm in a big hole. What made it? Oh, awesome. Rocks from space. Mm-hmm. We're mining those. That's a great source of wealth. So that's part of what drove me into astronomy, was the mining the sky, as John S. Lewis coined the phrase. But also, if anyone's ever been to the Sudbury Basin, there are some ecological ramifications of extracting that wealth.
That can be good, though. The Apollo astronauts trained up there partially because it was such a moonscape.
Yeah, the geology is good, and you know, it's impact craters with no trees on top. That's what you find on the moon, right? Well, we spent 100 years denuding the landscape, and we have a 100-year project of fixing it, I would think.
And we're doing quite well, but I remember my father works in the mining industry in for an engineering firm in Coppercliff, which is right next to the smelter, which, of course, is the last area they're going to get to in the remediation project. And so he took me out to the absolutely blare black hills, and you can stand and see nothing to the horizon except dead rock. And he says, "Son, this is my fault. I'm sorry about that." Which, of course, not literally true, because most of the damage was done at the early stage opening the mines.
Thankfully, London's a beautiful city.
Yeah, London's gorgeous. Although London had the same problem. London was actually treeless up until 1875. 5 when they moved the oil refineries to Sarnia after they burned down. Mm. But pollution from the oil refineries moonscaped London as well. So this is what a century-long remediation project looks like. It can get you
this
forest city.
Yeah,
exactly.
Amongst many other monikers you'll hear at the start of every show.
Yeah.
So, Dr. John, maybe we should talk about you now. You're trying to get out of this, but I don't think so.
Well, I suppose I can't just be the moderator.
So tell us how you got into planetary science.
Was it Star Trek?
Well, it kind of started with Star Trek. My parents were big fans of that. You know, we would take Saturdays and go and drive around Newfoundland. It was one of only a couple channels you could get back there, you know, without cable. And so I remember watching that, you know, like every Saturday for a long time. But more than that, I really liked the programming that was on PBS, for instance. Things like Nova. I remember that was the one thing I was allowed to stay up for when I was a kid. Parents were okay with staying up for that. And in Newfoundland, it comes on pretty late. Not as late as our show does, but still pretty late for a 7-year-old. And I remember seeing shows on, you know, astronomers, but the ones that I remember were the ones in the Voyager probes and what the folks at JPL were doing. And I don't know. I always hear kids talk about how they want to be an astronomer or they want to be particularly an astronaut when they grow up. I wanted to work at JPL. I thought that would be so cool, you know, telecommanding these robots out on the fringes of human knowledge and actually being there and seeing it. So it was always planetary for me.
And now you have done some of this.
It's true. I've been lucky, and my path has taken me by a few opportune places, in particular University of Arizona, which has had involvement, and I think their streak is still going. They've been on every NASA planetary mission that has been launched out there. But I managed to get myself hired on as a grad student of Peter Smith, and Peter was kind enough to, you know, take me around, show me the solar system with Mer and Huygens and Phoenix and a few other projects here and there. It was a great learning experience. And now I'm up here in Canada where we're trying to replicate some of the same things here at Western.
Not to mention MSL.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, I probably should mention MSL, which is a project we have ongoing now. And since this is playing on the Monday when we're due to have landed, you know better than I do how I'm feeling right now.
Knock on wood, everyone.
So the one person we haven't spoken about yet is the man who typically gets the last word.
That's what they call me.
Raymond Francis.
Hi.
So as the other person who lives in a crater, grew up there, I mean, what brought you here? You're also a great example, like I say, of the diversity that we have here. I mean, we're not all astronomers. Some of us are engineers. Some of us are, you know, you name it, educators. We've got them all.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a kind of complicated road to get here. I'm doing a doctorate here in engineering, one of the few engineers who works closely with the planetary science group. And, you know, this is the current project is engineering in robotics and vision systems to support planetary science. But to get here, I've gone through mechanical engineering and through human spaceflight and through ionospheric satellites and ideas about tracking aircraft from orbit, these kinds of projects. So I've been, you know, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, but now I'm doing this kind of planetary work, and it amuses me, so see if I can't keep it up.
The two are not, you know, it's not like night and day or oil and water. I mean, mm-hmm. The best projects have both of them working together. Mm-hmm. And Raymond's not the only engineer on this. I guess you could technically call me one of those as well, since mm-hmm. my undergrad degree was in engineering as it is.
Yeah, well, we have, I mean, there's a large engineering group here at Western, but I'm really into the idea of having science that is understood and engineerable and engineering that supports science. I really like to straddle that boundary, and I've been in places a couple of times to make those kinds of connections. And so that's what I'm trying to do here.
And that's very important, because those bridges aren't always there.
Mm-hmm.
And before you came here with your bridge building kit, they may not have been as strong as one might have hoped.
Well, we're working on it. And in particular, Dr. Rosinski, who is my co-supervisor for the PhD, is leading an effort to roll engineering more and more into what we do in the now well-established planetary science group.
Well, they feed off of one another. Mm-hmm. If you have good communication there, you can get better science.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't get to have any planetary science, really, without space missions, and you don't get to have space missions without engineers.
Right, I mean, we saw or heard that in a number of interviews that we did in season one, mm-hmm. where many people that were involved in missions were talking about both the engineering aspects as well as the science and how they really meld together.
Yeah, and if you're going to make instruments, you need to understand what they're going to be used for.
Exactly. You need that scientific context or else it is a problem. I mean, can you imagine someone asking you to go and design a car and not tell you where you were going to do it, what kind of things the car was expected to do? Is it meant to haul boulders or VIPs?
The application of new technologies to science has been giving new leaps and bounds of effort in planetary science since Galileo, at least. So let's continue to enable that kind of connection.
For sure.
It's always driven new science, and new science has always driven new technologies.
Mm-hmm. That's right. There's one thing about being out there on the edge. And that's one of the things I really loved when I was doing my engineering undergrad, is some of the space systems designs are just so elegant. You know, such a beautiful solution to the problem, because you're almost so constrained that there is only one solution.
Mm-hmm.
And
sometimes it seems a little wild.
It does, mm-hmm. but to an engineer it's very satisfying. So
what's interesting about that, just this afternoon, well, I was working on a spin-off technologies presentation to take it to the classrooms. You know, you can go on the NASA webpage and look at the spin-off technologies. And like you said, I mean, all of these technologies that have been created for these satellites and other missions, I mean, they're just, the technology is so applicable to use on Earth as well. I mean, they were talking about these micro cameras that they've built for certain instruments that went out to Mars or whatever. They're now in, if you have an iPhone or a BlackBerry with a camera, I think it said one in every three phones that have a camera in it is using this specific mm-hmm. technology. I mean, it's not like we're just throwing money away to create these weird technologies that are never going to be used again. I mean, it's very mm-hmm. useful for our world.
Yeah, and if you build up a capacity in society, not just a new technology that you can put into your coffee maker, but a capacity of developing solving these kinds of engineering problems, then you have a society that's full of engineers who can solve those kinds of problems and scientists mm-hmm. who understand them.
There's something to be said for the inspiration aspect.
This
Parshadi,
too.
You were brought in by visions of astronomy, right? Beautiful images, and I was brought in by, you know, imagination put forward largely by scientists, like Isaac Asimov was a scientist, and so forth, and yeah, so you help to inspire the next generations, you drive people forward and into interesting fields.
So it's not enough to publish your work where the science community will find it.
You have to go out
right.
and teach people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because, I mean, most of, at least in North America, most science is funded through the public purse. I mean, I think it's kind of, in a sense, our duty to get out there and show them, you know, these are the great things that we're doing with the money that you provided to us. And this is why it's interesting. This is why it's exciting. Mm-hmm. And to share that.
And I think in this time of, let's be honest, severe science cuts in this country, we really do need to get out there to tell people about what we're doing and why it's important, because otherwise it's just going to fly under the radar like so many of these things have been.
Yeah, we certainly need to sell ourselves in the marketplace of ideas. Otherwise, there will be no justification to open the public purse. This is a democracy, after all. And so, in theory, the will of the people... stop caring about the pretty pictures from space, we stop launching telescopes.
I think it's fairly easy sell, though. Most planetarium shows I've given, I've never had anyone come out and say,
boy, that was boring, yeah.
Yeah, you know what? Go ahead.
I think it's very important to influence people with different projects, because it's not commerce, it's not giving you money. So people need to generate interest to actually study these kinds of fields. It just comes from inside. It's not something else that actually drives you to such fields.
Right. They just have to be aware of it.
Yeah.
That's the thing. I mean,
yeah.
The number of students that have said, oh, I didn't even know people could do this as a living. I didn't know you could be an astronomer or be a planetary scientist or study space medicine. But I think in terms of reaching the public, I think, you know, sure, we can send a rover to Mars and look at that side of that rock and see what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But there's also things that the public are interested in. The journey is more interesting for the public, right, than the specific science that's going on.
Also, we've done so much cool stuff already that people aren't aware of. So
right.
if we go out and just tell people stuff that's already gone on, we can fill quite a lot of time.
Yeah, this
amazing
is interesting. Yeah.
Facts and
because there are robotic probes exploring nearly every planet in the solar system right now, and there's some going to comets and to
it's really an embarrassment of riches because you can't keep up with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's so fun to go out and talk about.
But the public is aware of the Mars rovers and maybe not a lot else.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Rosetta probe that's on its way to a comet, the Dawn probe that's
it's already
looking at asteroids.
It's already in the belt doing great science. But that's just planetary chauvinism. We can relate to things like Earth.
Mm-hmm.
Mars has a sky. If you don't have a sky,
mm-hmm.
you seem to be lower down on the pecking order in terms of just the imaginative interest that the public generates.
The fact that we can land on a comet, take measurements of various asteroids, you know, if we can put Bruce Willis on it, then that's pretty cool.
Well, we haven't reached a comet quite yet.
I think...
We sampled tails.
Yeah, we've never put a lander on the nucleus yet.
We're working on it.
Yeah,
I think scientists need to do a better job of it, though. We're doing all this cool stuff, but no one's telling anyone.
Well, no, we are. We're shouting into...
In very small, little, tiny...
Yeah, that's what we're doing here. And every scientist who has the opportunity will talk anyone's ear off. It's a matter of getting the opportunity and getting people to listen and getting them to care. Because if you have Jersey Shore on Channel 3 and us on Channel 4, we know which is going to get the better viewership. And I'm sorry, it's not us.
I think what we need to keep in mind, though, is that we don't need to turn everyone into a scientist. Not everyone has to become a planetary scientist or an engineer. My whole goal in life is just to get people somehow interested in science at a very basic level. I want this public to be scientifically literate when the government starts cutting programs, they might have some sort of background knowledge to realize how important it might be.
And even then, it's not just a question of fighting for a place in the marketplace of ideas. It's not about trying to convince people to buy into our thing that we do instead of something else. Communicating the knowledge of how the universe is of inherent value.
Mm-hmm.
Not just of kind of mercenary, pragmatic value of selling people on paying for planetary missions.
Right.
And it's not just about us. I mean, if you have a scientifically literate citizenry, then you can actually talk about these trades in a way that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you understand what you lose when you cut and what you gain when you fund more. So very quickly, here at the end, I'm just going to go around the room and see what people's favorite episode was from the first season. Let's start with Parshdi.
I think I love Catherine Nish talking about the lifeboat on one of the moons of the Sun.
Oh, Titan.
Titan.
I think David Southwood gave a fantastic description and a way of thinking about a career in space and in general, about how to approach your work and how it fits into the context of the world.
That was my favorite one, too. I just thought the way that he kind of talked about it was kind of everything, you know, summarized into, and he just the way he spoke, you could just tell that he was very passionate about his work, and he was just so excited that he was able to take part in the Cassini mission. And if we had people like that around...
I really liked Melissa Battler's interview where she was talking about the Mars analog missions. Stuff that's done right here on Earth, but that puts you in the mind frame of exploring Mars and really establishes, hopefully, what will be going on in the future. And I thought that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I got to say, I liked Across the Disk of Crimson, the one with Dave McCarter talking about the Venus transit. It's such a rare event. It's something that anyone can see with very little aid. And I don't know, it's just a very immediate thing in the moment, brings it back what's out there to everyone.
I especially enjoyed that episode, too. And the historical context behind the Venus transit, the fact that this is not an everyday event, this is a once, and not even a once in a century event, really puts us into the continuity of human minds.
And so important historically, like that measurement of the timing of how long it took to cross the sun gave us the distance of an AU.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it put the whole solar system into scale.
And from your perspective, from an outreach perspective, it was the best thing that can happen.
Yeah.
We had over 3,000 people at Western's Transit of Venus event.
Yeah, and I just love how it gives you a sense of deep time.
Yeah.
And the idea that basically these yawning chasms of over 100 years, there's very few people alive now who probably still will be when it comes around again.
Yeah, it's very easy to look up at the sky at night or during the day and see a fixed firmament that is sitting there and has staticness built into it and not realize that it's all moving, that it's all swirling around and active and happening and evolving on the scale of minutes and billions of years, and that we're part of it.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured a discussion between co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Dave Kirsch, John Moores, Parshdi Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were John Moores and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.